this edition of So Ill, we hear from Dr. Megan Stiles about the impact of sustainability practices on the University of Illinois Springfield campus and the importance of policy change for our future as a community.
Guys, welcome everyone to the So Ill podcast, back for another episode. This is Camille, your host. I'm a medical student at SIU.
I am Justin. I'm also a medical student at SIU.
And hi everyone, I'm Dr. Megan Stiles. I'm a professor in the Environmental Studies program at the University of Illinois Springfield, here in Springfield.
Gotcha. So just to start, thank you so much for being on the podcast, Dr. Stiles. Just to kind of begin, could you tell us a little bit about your interests as well as how you got into the topic of studying the environment?
Sure. So I have a PhD in environmental anthropology from the University of Washington. So my research focuses on sort of the social and political dimensions of environmental problems and environmental conflicts. And I've been here at the University of Illinois Springfield since 2014, but I'm actually a Springfield native. I grew up here. I'm a graduate of Southeast High School. And it was exciting when I was looking for academic jobs to be able to come back home. So I'm very committed to our community. And I got interested in the environmental field when I was an undergraduate. So I went to Washington University in St. Louis. And when I was getting ready to enroll, I actually got a postcard in the mail that talked about this undergraduate program in environmental studies where you can go camping with your professors and learn about all kinds of exciting things. And I knew I wanted to be an anthropology major, but I thought that looked pretty fun. So I signed up for it. And, you know, 2 years after doing that first and second year program in environmental studies, it was called the Hewlett program at the time at WashU, I was a double environmental studies and anthropology major, and now I'm an environmental studies professor. So it was my experience as an undergraduate that really triggered that interest for me.
That's wonderful. I'm glad that they were able to steer you into something you ended up being passionate with. And to think it was just a small postcard at the very beginning.
Yeah, I'm not sure. Probably it would be an email now, but it used to be a postcard.
That's wonderful. Could you tell us a little bit about how on the UIS campus, you teach your environmental studies classes, but what are some other ways that you kind of get students involved and show them the importance of sustaining our environment?
Oh yeah, that's a great question. So for a long time, I've been the co-chair of our Campus Senate Committee on Sustainability at UIS, which is a committee that has faculty and staff and students where we try to make the campus a little bit greener and engage with the community. So I've got that committee. And for a long time, we wanted to try to increase student engagement. So in 2016, we had a referendum through the Student Government Association to create a green fee at UIS. So on-campus students pay a $5 semester fee called the green fee. And then we have a student-led committee that makes decisions about how to use that money. And we have a proposal process where students, faculty, and staff can turn in a letter of intent and then a proposal for any project that they want to see on the campus or in the community that will enhance the sustainability of our university and of Springfield. And so I'm also the faculty advisor for that student-led committee. And then we also have an on-campus garden, the UIS Community Garden, and I'm the faculty advisor for that garden as well, which also started in 2016. That was a big year for us. And that also was a student-led initiative that came out of my Intro to Sustainability class. So I've got the classes that I teach in environmental studies, and then we have these great sort of student-led initiatives and faculty-led initiatives to really engage with sustainability issues at UIS and in Springfield.
Oh, that's wonderful. We're actually, this is SIU, but we're actually a club that benefits from the green fee at our university. So very, Yay. Very useful. When thinking about, the green fee projects that the university funds, as well as the community garden, do, any of the projects that you fund or like the community garden, do either of those have like a direct effect on like student health? Like, does anything in the community garden go to the dining hall, or any of the funded projects have to do with like reminding people about like wearing masks or things like that?
Yeah, that's a really good question. So I'll start with the garden first. So the garden, kind of the size of it varies from year to year. But in past years, we have different ways of dispersing the produce that we grow. So all of it goes usually to the volunteers who come out to the garden who participate in our work nights, but we also have a rule that there is no stealing in the UIS community garden and that it is open to anybody from the wider community at any time. So anybody can come and harvest, whether they've put in any work in the garden in the past. It's really important to us that they have access to those fresh vegetables and things that are growing in the garden. And then when we have really good growing years and we've got more than our volunteers can take, we have in the past donated some of the produce to food banks in the Springfield area. We had a student that was really well connected to the downtown farmers market, and they have a program where at the end of every market day they collect leftover produce and take it to the food bank. And so we were bringing our produce to the farmers market and donating it as part of that program. And then some of our produce has ended up in our campus food bank and in the local dining hall, although the last few growing seasons haven't been quite enough to kind of sustain that well, but we do also direct some of our produce there. We actually have a challenge with the on-campus food bank because we don't have any water out at the garden, so we can't wash anything, you know. So we're always trying to convince people that it's okay for produce to be dirty and you can take it and you can wash it. But, you know, it can be hard when you grow fresh produce and you donate it to the on-campus food bank, which is really set up to be like prepared goods and things that are refrigerated. It can be hard to mix fresh vegetables into that because, you know, they may still have the dirt on them and there may not be a way to keep them from perishing if students aren't coming and taking that stuff really quickly. So we're working with the food bank to try to improve those processes, but we definitely want to see, you know, students taking that produce. And even without the food bank, it's, you know, most of our volunteers and participants are students that live on campus. And then during the pandemic, the garden really flourished because we had a lot of students, especially international students, were kind of trapped on campus and we were the only outdoor thing that they could do. You know, they were kind of excited to get access to that fresh produce during that point in time too. And then you also asked about the green fee initiatives. I would say that, you know, from our perspective, everything that has to do with the environment is, you know, centrally linked into health concerns and social equity concerns. Some are kind of more of a direct link than others. So a lot of our projects are kind of focused on infrastructure stuff, like reducing water and energy use on campus. But we have started to have more service events to get students out and to meet together to think about issues. So we probably could stand to have a few more, though, that are kind of explicitly health focused. You're inspiring me to think more about that as kind of a dimension for us to expand into.
It sounds like you guys are doing a lot of great stuff already, though. Fresh fruits and vegetables are definitely, you know, that's the cornerstone of our health right there. Whatever you're putting in, it's going to come out some way. But another question I kind of have, and Justin, feel free to jump in if I'm just like dominating the conversation.
You're good. Keep it up.
Another question I have is getting into the recycling initiative that you have going on campus. What kind of do you have the students doing? You know, how are they making other students aware of the importance of recycling? What's going on there?
Yeah, so that's a good question. Recycling, like many things, you know, we've done different things in different years to try to increase our recycling rates at UIS. And so just before the pandemic, we actually, two colleagues and I did a research study with a few of our student research assistants, where we were examining ways of trying to get students more excited about recycling. And so we bought these recycling bins that had cute pictures of outdoor scenes and little frogs on them. And the study was focused on whether or not having those nature scenes on the recycling bins create what's sometimes called in the marketing world a warm glow effect, where if somebody sort of sees those cute things, they have fuzzy feelings and they're more likely to engage in whatever the thing is you want them to do. We put those recycling bins that were decorated, we call them our bedazzled bins, we paired them with regular recycling bins at random locations on campus, and then we actually audited all of the recyclables that ended up in both the regular bins and the bedazzled bins to see whether or not the bedazzled bins were drawing more recyclables. And unfortunately, what we found is that there really wasn't a statistically significant difference between the regular bins and the bedazzled bins. But it, you know, even though we found that that really didn't work as a method for increasing engagement with recycling, the research project itself was great because it gave us an opportunity to talk to students about what was happening, especially after the study when we revealed the results. We had the student research assistants who were going through and picking through all the recyclables and weighing them all. And it gave us an opportunity to audit the things that were going in the recycling bins to see what students were confused about. So we sorted those into things that were actually recyclable and things that were not recyclable. recyclable that had ended up in those bins. So it allowed us to kind of understand whether we were cycling well and then what was going on with wish cycling. So wish cycling is when people are kind of hopeful something's going to be recyclable, so they throw it in the bin. And we found all kinds of things that, you know, students were obviously hoping would be recyclable, and we could adjust our message, our educational message, to kind of focus on, you know, what was and wasn't recycled on campus. But I think in general, even apart from that study, we're always looking for ways to increase our recycling rates. And, you know, we have a turnover in students every year, so it's something that really has to be an ongoing concerted effort. And we could certainly do that better at UIS. Before the pandemic, we had a lot of pretty good dynamic programs. The pandemic sort of threw things off a little bit, especially because there were a lot of programs that we had to reduce waste on campus that had to be thrown out during the pandemic. We had to go back, for instance, to using throwaway containers in our eateries and things like that. Yeah, we're starting to get back now after the pandemic into kind of the strength of some of those programs. And we've reintroduced our reusable clamshells for taking your food out of the food services at UIS and things like that. A little bit of a long-winded answer. Please feel free to ask me any follow-up questions about anything if you want me to drill in on something.
No worries. That was a bunch of good information. I think one question I do have is, you know, there's the concept that you talked about of wish cycling, things that you thought were going to be recyclable. I know people do that with umbrellas a lot. They'll throw umbrellas in the recycling bin thinking like, oh yeah, somebody else can use this. And it's like, no, they really can't, you know. Results of the study aside, equal things for bedazzled cans and non-bedazzled cans. Do you think recycling in general could use a rebrand to kind of help people better understand and be more actively engaged?
Always. Yeah, it's just a continual education process. And so when I teach about recycling in my intro to sustainability class, one of the first things that I always emphasize is that recycling is supposed to be just one of the R's, right? Reducing the number of single-use things that you use and reusing things is really the really important. And we really need to focus on those pieces of a sustainable waste management system so that we generate less waste that has to be recycled. Because recycling is largely effective in many areas, but it's not totally effective. There's still a lot of things that are thrown away, and there's still a lot of wasted natural resources that go into making things that, you know, can be imperfectly turned into something else, but it would have been far better to never create that thing in the first place or to use something reusable. So if I'm thinking, for instance, of plastic bottles, right? Plastic bottles are theoretically recyclable, but you're using petroleum products to create that product in the beginning. It's easy to replace a plastic water bottle, for instance, with a reusable water bottle. And then even though those things can be recycled, the markets for those products are not as strong as they should be. So it's not necessarily the case that the companies that make those water bottles, for instance, are taking them back and reusing them as water bottles. They're going into kind of park benches and fleeces made out of plastic and other interesting things, but it's still kind of a fairly wasteful process, and those microplastics that shear off of our fleece vests and escape the environment, even through that a process of trying to recycle those things, are still out there and are still an environmental concern and a health concern. So I always just want to emphasize, you know, that recycling isn't really the answer. The answer is reducing and reusing and moving more towards a zero waste system or a circular economy where we're not generating so much waste that has to even be recycled. And then when it comes to recycling, I think a lot of people have kind of this impression that it's that everything gets thrown out, right? When we talk to people on campus about why they don't recycle, there's usually two answers. One is like, well, it's pointless anyway because it all gets thrown out. Or I just don't know how to do it and it seems like a pain in the butt and I just don't have time to figure it out. So in answer to that first problem of it all getting thrown out, that's really a misconception, right? The businesses that collect our waste are businesses, and they would not continue collecting our waste if they weren't able to take those products and sell them on as secondary products on a market. They have a market for that waste. I think the impression that a lot of stuff gets thrown away comes from the fact that for instance, here in Springfield, a lot of us that have waste management or have Republic as our waste haulers, we have a single stream recycling system. So that means that plastic, cardboard, aluminum, they can all go into the same bucket, and then our waste hauler collects that. And then that goes to a municipal recycling facility. It goes to one in Bloomington, where they then have to sort all that material back out into the different kinds of materials that, and then they have markets for those materials, markets for certain kinds of plastic, markets for papers, markets for glass. And that process does take a lot of effort. And because there's a lot of contamination in that waste stream, because people aren't sure what to recycle or they just kind of throw everything in, there are things that get thrown away, even at the municipal recycling facility. But That is only a percentage of the materials that come in. There's still a large percentage of the materials that are effectively recycled and are sold on to these other markets and become new products. So just because your recycling facility throws away some of the stuff that people tried to recycle doesn't mean that the whole thing is a failure. And that really is not true. And then when it comes to not knowing how to recycle, you know, people can be forgiven for that because every municipality might have different regulations and different rules around this. And so it's always good to do your research and or have someone do the research for you. If there's, you know, a group like you that's environmentally involved on campus, get in contact with your municipal recycling facility, with your waste hauler who handles your recycling, and find out what really is recyclable in your waste stream. It's almost always the case that plastics 1 through 5, aluminum cans, paper, cardboard, those things are recyclable in any municipality. But then some big cities will be able to recycle plastic number 6, which is like styrofoam and materials that we can't recycle here in Springfield. There are some companies that will take back toothpaste tubes and you know, pouches with little food for little kids. But those are corporate specific recycling programs where you have to get those specific products back to that company in order for it to work. You can't just throw it in your own recycling bin. So I think, you know, sort of understanding the basics of what can go in your waste stream, having really good labels on your bins, and having continuing education at your institution, and having people that are recycling leaders is really important, because, you know, there's always a turnover in employees or a turnover in students, and you can't just teach one group of people to recycle and expect for it to work forever. It's an ongoing education campaign that's needed.
That's very interesting, you know, especially that last part about having to reteach, because there's like knowledge loss with each kind of like generation of students and workers. Kind of a little bit of a segue, but very similar topic. We actually, in our club, we host like a journal club. And one of the topics we discussed was about how in the healthcare field, we have to use so much single-use plastic, and how, you know, this is protecting our patients, of course. You know, we have disease risk to think about, you know, infection spread and control. But how can us as, you know, clinicians and medical students, like, be a little more mindful? Are there like getting conversations with these manufacturers about taking some of these single-use items back, you know, things like that?
Yeah, really good question. And, you know, part of the answer is going to be watch this space, because this is a really important emerging conversation. There's, you know, been a backlash against single-use plastics, especially. And I think that the European Union is really leading with legislation that's actually going to ban some of these things. So there may be cities, for instance, and states in the US that ban single-use plastic bags, but we're really kind of stuck on bags, whereas in other parts of the world, they're focusing not just on single-use plastic bags, but on other types of single-use plastic. And I think in that whole conversation, medical uses are one of kind of the protected spaces, right? I don't think that many people are willing to say we can't have single-use places in the medical field because of the need for sterility and, you know, the life-saving capacity of these things. But I think that as single-use plastics begin to be eliminated in other fields, and there's good research that starts to lead us to alternatives for what could be done, we'll start to see movement in that space. So some of it could be going back to using glass and autoclaving and, you know, really having procedures like, you know, they did originally before single-use plastics were quite so readily available, to take things that have already been used and sterilize them. Although that's, you know, another set of resources that's used in that, and it can be quite complicated to kind of revert to those older technologies, but they are out there and they are available. Another space where people are kind of exploring this is with non-petroleum based plastics, so bioplastics. Is there a way to use other types of material that can more easily decompose or are less toxic at the point of manufacture to make some of these things like pipette tips? And I actually had a student who was preparing one of our green fee proposals for this year on campus, Carmen Flesh, if you're out there, Carmen, she has been researching this for the UIS campus, if there is a way to use fewer single-use plastics like pipettes in some of our labs for biology and chemistry classes. And her research so far hasn't really come to a firm conclusion, because there's a lot of things to consider, right? So, and one of them is, if you are switching to another product that is made from bioplastics, you know, what are the statistics about the life cycle of those bioplastics. How many resources does it take to manufacture them? Can they really decay in the, or do they cause additional problems for incineration, for instance, of medical waste? So how much more sustainable are they really? You know, are there other opportunities to start reusing some things like we would have done in the 70s, for instance, on the UIS campus? You know, she's really involved in researching this. Lots of really smart people globally are involved in researching this because a lot of like that sheer amount of waste that comes out of clinical settings is staggering for everyone involved. And I think it's honestly going to take regulation from the top that bans certain kinds of things so that people are forced to find alternatives. And I think the piece that you mentioned is so important for both medical waste and single-use plastics, but also for, you know, our own consumer products is to regulations or guidance or incentives that force manufacturers to change what they're making their materials out of are really important because then it's, you know, the onus, the burden isn't on the consumer to be the one who has to make all of these split decisions and research all these things. You know, the experts who are manufacturing these things are doing that research, are trying to sub in different materials, are thinking about how to reduce waste, and then we're all benefiting, you know, downstream from those decisions having been made. And you could also have additional programs that either voluntarily or, you know, through regulatory sticks force manufacturers to take back and recycle or reuse or clean some of the things that they're using. So my hope is that we're going to see some of the pressure that's building, for instance, in the European Union, leading to more regulations around single-use plastics, more regulations for manufacturers about what they're using and how they take them back, and some kind of movement in that space towards really creating a circular economy within the manufacturing space to help with some of the problems that you talked about.
I absolutely hope so. I've only heard of one real pipeline for medical recycling, and that's recalled pacemakers being sent to veterinarians to be used for dogs. And I think that's a wonderful reuse. We can't put them in the patient because, you know, they don't have the maintenance or, you know, the pacemaker's not getting updates anymore. A dog can definitely, who has a much shorter lifespan, can definitely use that device. And so I hope in the future to see more of that.
Yeah, and I think, I mean, you all, medical students and people in the medical field have to be the leaders in this too. The more that you push and the more questions you ask, and I'm sure you don't have time to do a ton of research, but the more you kind of seek out the research that's been done and ask the questions that inspire new research. And, you know, a place like SIU is so important because you are a research medical facility that, you know, one of the avenues of research is how to reduce these kinds of waste or reuse these products. The more you all push for that and ask for that, the more likely it is to come into being.
Absolutely.
I do like what you've said, how you just kind of ended your last idea. And it was for us to ask the right questions that will kind of push towards, you know, this reduction in single-use plastics. And as a researcher yourself, you have a lot of insight on how to ask the right questions. So that's just something I'm sitting with right now. So we'll kind of be switching gears a bit back to the kind of sustainability. You had mentioned before a lot of the work that you do is in sustainability and agriculture. What are the kind of initiatives you implement to make agriculture more sustainable from, I guess, what it is currently?
Yeah, so I, you know, I teach these sustainability classes and I've had to learn a lot about things like recycling for that. But my actual research focus myself is that for many years I researched rose farming in Kenya. So in Kenya, they grow roses for the European market. It's a major source of foreign exchange and employment, but it's a controversial industry because of concerns about labor conditions in the industry and then the environmental impacts of rose growing. Roses are very water intensive. They're very resource intensive in terms of the amount of chemical pesticides and fertilizers you might need to use to grow those roses. And so my research kind of focused on both those impacts of the industry, but then also how people that were involved in rose farming organized themselves to try to improve and alleviate some of those impacts and make the industry more responsive to workers' needs and workers' rights and to environmental concerns. And then more recently, I've started a project looking at hemp farming in Illinois. So hemp farming has only been legal since 2019 in Illinois. It was legalized in the 2018 Farm Bill, and then the first growing season was really in 2019, although people could grow it for research purposes earlier than that. And so hemp is interesting because because it's one of the crops that Illinois farmers might choose to grow in a rotation with corn and soy, or as an alternative to corn and soy to help with soil remediation and to help kind of alleviate the coming effects of climate change. So farmers in Illinois are very interested in experimenting with novel crops and trying to figure out what is going to allow them to kind of deal with changing climatic factors and changing international markets and things like that. So my research has kind of focused not necessarily on small community gardens or even on small scale, resilient, regionalized agriculture, which is obviously a major component of a sustainable agriculture system, but on kind of these big commodity crops that get sold to farmers as development opportunities and how well that works for them. So that's just to give you a little bit of a background on my research. And I think in terms of what the research shows is most sustainable, you know, I really admire the work of the Illinois Stewardship Alliance, which is an organization based in Springfield that is a statewide organization that works with farmers to organize for a more sustainable and equitably just food system in Illinois and in the United States. And, you know, their approach is to really organize farmers and eaters to work together to find policy solutions that make it possible for farmers to make the decision to use more sustainable agricultural practices. In sustainability, the answer is often already there. We know what to do. It's not like it's a huge puzzle. We know that you need to grow more crops of different kinds and have, you know, support biodiversity within a farm environment. We know that we need to have resilient regionalized food systems where people are growing more of the fruits and vegetables that are being bought and sold locally. And that's why, you know, sustainable farm advocates are so excited about farmers markets and things like that. But we also know that it is very hard for farmers to participate in those sustainable economies because they don't have the access to the same resources that a conventional farmer does. So making sure that the policy system incentivizes and supports farmers as they try to convert from conventional and industrial agricultural methods that might be environmentally and socially destructive to things that are more restorative and productive is really important. That policy is really the window. And you'll notice that I talked about that too, with thinking about how to get rid of single-use plastics and wastes in medical. You know, you can only do so much as a conscious consumer, you know, making individual choices. You can have a lot bigger impact as a member of a representative democracy trained to policy tools to change things at the collective level for everyone.
You made a point about recycling companies, you know, being businesses, and that's not something that we kind of remember, you know, or we consciously think about. And like you said, like there's a market for certain things, and there has to be kind of this like mutual benefit amongst parties. And so we get into policy, we get into that, and like, how do we pass legislation to make these things more viable? And so I'm just curious, how do you think one would go about to make these connections with, I don't know, certain businesses, or how do we make this look more appealing and more mutually beneficial across bigger entities and sustainability or recycling?
Yeah, that's a good question. So, you know, if I think, for instance, about the municipal recycling facilities and the markets they try to develop for the materials, I think there might be lots of manufacturers who would like to take and use recycled materials, but having additional funding available to help them, you know, adjust their manufacturing processes so that they could take a recycled material and it would be cost effective for them to use that instead of a virgin material is good. They could always use financial support to kind of make those shifts. And I think the other thing that goes on behind the scenes is that the things that are bad for the environment are often subsidized by policy and economic processes. So as long as power lies with the petroleum companies that are using all of their lobbyists to kind of sell us on the idea that you can buy that thing that you want and then it's just recyclable and you can feel good about it, that virgin plastic, for instance, is going to be cheaper than recycled plastic. So I think we need to keep working on that end where we're not using taxpayer money to subsidize the destructive thing. We're shifting the subsidies to help out the person who wants to use the more responsible practice. It's probably one way to think about that. I, for instance, don't know enough about, I'm not running a recycling business. So I think as an anthropologist, the way that I might answer that question, if I don't have the answer, is ask the people who do know. So for instance, you know, when you were talking before about it resonating with you as a medical student, that you might be the one who has to push for this kind of change. You're also the person who knows, you know, which of the products you use probably are things that you cannot get rid of, because if somebody were to reuse that in the wrong way, somebody's going to die. And which things are you're just kind of throwing away because that's what's easiest, right? But that there probably is a way to you know, have that product be reused or have it be made out of something different. So, you know, you see yourself as a source of information. Your everyday practices are, you know better than anybody else from an ethnographic point of view, kind of what could go and what could change. And even your hospital is a system, and you know who you need to advocate, who you need to get to advocate for different things, you know? So I think if everything feels overwhelming sometimes that you can't deal with single-use plastics as a global phenomenon, start at home. That's what we teach the students with the green fee at UIS. You know, if you identify a small problem that you think you can leverage change on, and then if it works, scale it up and scale it out. So that kind of thing, and see yourself as an expert. Don't, you know, based on your own experience, don't be afraid to draw on that expertise. And so if to go back to the recycling question, you know, let's ask the municipal recyclable and the folks that like the small businesses like that want a bottle beer and a recycled bottle and have that be part of what they can advertise to consumers. Let's ask them what is stopping you from doing that at a larger scale, and then help give them what they need to do that well.
Yeah, as you said that, it just gave me thoughts back to, you know, our surgery rotation, which we just got off of a couple of weeks ago. And there's like a lot of tubing and like plastic tubing and IV tube, like different plastic things that we use for one patient and we throw away. And you mentioned before, you know, some companies may recycle this material and some may not. It doesn't feel too far out of reach to find a company that would maybe have something that they can use, do with this to recycle it. So, you know, as you said that, it just made me think.
Yeah, could you make, and you know, think of it from a systems perspective too, right? If you, what is the environmental impact of that thing? Could we use a different type of material that maybe is a little worse to make it? Could it be recycled? Could it be reused? And sometimes the answer is no, and that has to be okay. For some things, the answers will be no. And that's also important too, to not let people use the example of the thing that can't be recycled to then shut down the conversation about the other things that are in the ecosystem that could be recycled too. Because some people will say, do you really want a patient to die because you recycled the tube you used to suck the blood out of that wound? I mean, the answer is no, and I'm probably not going to focus on that particular tube. But let's think about this other thing that we're also using a ton of that is a lower hanging fruit.
Absolutely. I also think of all of, me and Justin were on surgery at the same time, like all the times where the wrong tool was opened. They open a tool, the surgeon, oh, I don't actually need that. And so that also goes in the trash, you know, even though it was untouched, technically still not sterile, but technically clean. And all the times like a recycling opportunity was wasted due to those just human error.
Yeah, so see yourself as a good source of information. You are more of an expert than you might have given yourself credit for.
Well, Dr. Stiles, of course, thank you so much. But is there anything, you know, final parting thoughts that you would want to share with the viewer?
Sometimes just feel overwhelmed by the enormity of environmental challenges. And so, you know, what I usually teach people in my class is that there's probably already a solution out there that someone has developed that you can research and possibly apply or think about altering so that it fits your situation. So you don't feel like you have to be the one that reinvents the wheel to solve every problem. And don't think you're alone, because like I said before, collective action sometimes works best. And so the kinds of things that you all are doing to get lots of people involved and organized around something is really good. And, you know, connecting with organizations like the Illinois Stewardship Alliance, or I'm sure that they're is some kind of an environmental organization in the medical field that you could connect with that might be already working towards some of this stuff. You know, connect with others, and then always think about policy routes for changing problems, but also think about starting locally and starting small and then seeing where that takes you. You don't have to impact things at the global level in order to fix them. It has to start small somewhere.
Awesome parting words. Thank you so much.
Thank you so much.
Thank you for the opportunity. It was really nice to meet you both, and I hope our paths cross again soon.
Dr. Megan Stiles is an associate professor of environmental studies at University of Illinois Springfield. Tune in next time for another enlightening episode of So Ill. This podcast is a collaborative production between the SIU School of Medicine and WSIU Public Broadcasting. You can find more episodes at wsiu.org.